Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us today. Good news on the Woolsey fire. It's now more than half contained. They're still looking at full containment by this Sunday. Winds have died down in the communities that have been so devastated or threatened by the Woolsey fire, which broke out last Thursday afternoon, a week ago. With us on the latest on folks getting back into Malibu from the areas that have reopened to residents is managing editor of the Malibu Times, Emily Sawicki. Emily, thank you for joining us again.
Hi, thank you.
So what are you seeing as you drive around the city?
We are seeing more cars on the road, definitely, between Topanga, which is sort of the unofficial start of the city of Malibu, all the way up to Webway, and a lot of officer presence, mostly L.A. County sheriff's deputies in their vehicles at pretty much, I think, every canyon road that leads up from Pacific Coast Highway.
So they're checking everybody's ID to make sure that their residents going back to the area. Where people are going back, is there significant structural loss in some of the areas where people are now returning?
Absolutely not. The fire was pretty much contained, I believe, at Malibu Canyon, and Webway is the next traffic light down for Malibu Canyon. So when people are coming back, they're seeing virtually no signs of damage, no downed power poles. They have lights, they have electricity. They're pretty much coming back to their normal neighborhood.
All right. And what about smoke? Is there still much of it in the air there?
Not that we're seeing here. We're on Las Flores. I'm in my office right now. And up and down Las Flores, which is pretty much right between Topanga and Webway. It's perfect blue sky.
All right. We're talking with Malibu Times Managing Editor Emily Sawicki. I'd love to hear from you if you have a moment that you could join us if you're in Malibu and have returned to your home within the past 24 hours. I'd be interested in hearing what you're seeing on your block, in your neighborhood, what it's like for you to reconnect with your neighbors who maybe you haven't had a chance to directly talk with or see over the course of the past several days. We're at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. Again, if you're a resident of the eastern portion of Malibu, getting back into your house over the past few hours, I'd appreciate you sharing with us the experience, what you've come home to, what the protocols have been for you to get back into the neighborhood, and just what you're experiencing reconnecting with your fellow evacuees. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Emily, any new information about a projected timeline for those coming back into the areas that have heavily burned?
Nothing that we're aware of. I know that utility companies and the city and Caltrans have been flooding the area with workers, replacing burned power poles, fixing broken gas lines. But there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, we were hearing from the mayor yesterday that among, you know, the canyon roads where the fire has been, I was trying to remember if it's Encinal or which one of the canyons, just about all of the power poles have been burned and have to be replaced.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking to see. I had the opportunity to drive up into a couple of canyons, including the Malibu Park neighborhood, and it's poles were still down across roads. I saw a fire truck that had to make a 3-point turn to avoid crossing over a pole that had completely blocked one of the roads up there.
Also, for the residents back in their homes, are they still being asked to boil water, or have they been given the all clear on the potability of their water?
It's my understanding that all the water in the areas where people are repopulating is safe to drink.
Okay. All right. We're talking with Emily Sawicki of the Malibu Times. We had night before last a rather contentious meeting at Santa Monica High School for the evacuees. What's your sense of how the city's responding to some of the concerns that were expressed by multiple people at the meeting?
I think that the city is dealing with a lot of agencies right now. Malibu, of course, contracts out its police and fire with LA County. They're also dealing with Southern California Edison, the Office of Emergency from the LA County, and our water is two different water districts. So I think what the city's trying to do is sort of manage all of these different agencies to try to serve the community as well as they can. And people are frustrated because people who know that their houses survived, I don't think fully understand why they're not being allowed back in yet.
All right. And not necessarily satisfied still by the city's answers to that.
Sure. Yeah, no, they're not.
All right. Which is, my understanding, has to do with the surrounding infrastructure, what you're mentioning about utilities, access, police resources to control looting, all of those sorts of, you know, challenges the city's dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Emily, thank you so much. Appreciate your being with us.
Thank you.
Emily Sawicki, managing editor of the Malibu Times. Also with us from North State Public Radio in Chico, NPR member station, reporter Mark Albert, who has been covering the Camp Fire, which just devastated the town of Paradise to the south and east of Chico. Mark, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's an honor and a pleasure.
What's just the latest on the status of the fire itself?
Well, the fire continued to grow overnight, another 2,000 acres. CAL FIRE now, their latest estimate is 140,000 acres. And just to remind your listeners, this fire started just a little bit over, well, several hours more than a week ago today. There are additional fatalities or additional remains were recovered. So far, the total is 56. There are an additional, that's 56 fatalities known. Authorities are waiting for DNA analysis before they release names, although they've tentatively identified 47 of the victims. There are an additional 130 people confirmed missing. So the death toll could very well rise and could rise substantially. People are getting over their initial shock of being able to make it out alive, and people are starting to be more and more anxious to get back to what they think are their homes. I've been out in Paradise, and I have to say it is a total shambles. It is very difficult to describe. Governor Brown was here yesterday along with Ken Pimlott, the director of CAL FIRE, the director of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, Brock Long. It's going to be a long recovery process. And I can't emphasize enough how different, almost a tale of two fires. Malibu, of course, being one of California's most affluent communities. Paradise, kind of a more working class Lake Tahoe. Beautiful country, windy roads, tall, mature, stately ponderosa pines, but many people living in mobile home parks. Most of the people there are over 65 or senior citizens, folks who saved up everything they could their entire lives, may be underinsured. Folks, certainly many of them unable to return to work if they need to. This is going to be a major challenge. There are something about on the order of 8,400 single-family homes that were destroyed, and this is not a particularly prosperous nor particularly populous county. There's 280,000 people in the county, so you know, just a kind of a wild guess, but we would say about 10% of the county's housing stock has been wiped out.
And even to, you know, get for those able to rebuild, whose insurance would cover it or replace their mobile home. You know, just logistically to get the workforce to do all this with the thousands of units that have been destroyed. I mean, this is going to be an extraordinary multi-year effort, obviously. Mark, thank you so much for sharing with us the latest about the Camp Fire and all of us in Southern California, even though we're dealing with our fire here. Send our condolences over the tremendous loss and upheaval to the trauma and the lives of those up in your area. This is Air Talk on KPCC. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. You know, I've been reading news coverage of the study published over the weekend in the New England Journal of Medicine, which looked at multiple years of individuals using fish oil supplements in different degrees and vitamin D to see what effect it would have on heart health as well as on cancer, deaths related to cancer. I came away a little bit confused, a little bit unclear about, you know, what promise is there, what seems to be a dead end in terms of a benefit. So what better than to bring the lead author of what's called the Vital Study, published in the New England Journal, Dr. Joanne Manson. She's practicing physician and chief of the Division of Preventive Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and a professor of epidemiology at Harvard. Dr. Manson, good to have you with us.
Great. It's great to be here, Larry.
So let's talk first of all about the fish oil supplements, the idea that it would have a protective benefit for heart health, that it might have some benefits, potential for cancer as well. What did you find in this study about the different intensities of fish oil?
So for the omega-3 fish oil, 1 gram a day, we found only a small, statistically non-significant reduction of about 8% in the primary endpoint of major cardiovascular events. But we did see a 28% reduction in heart attack risk, no reduction in stroke or cardiovascular mortality. Interestingly, it was those who had low fish consumption at baseline who seemed to have the greater benefit in terms of total cardiovascular events and heart attack. They did have a significant reduction in both the primary endpoint of combined major cardiovascular events as well as heart attack when looked at separately.
And that's only 1 gram a day.
Only 1 gram a day.
Okay. Then some were given a prescription level, and what's the difference there in the amount, and what did you see in that group?
That was a separate trial that tested 4 grams a day of just one of the types of omega-3s, the EPA, and that trial showed in a high-risk population a very substantial reduction in total cardiovascular events. We were testing the 1 gram a day in a usual risk, what we call a primary prevention population of people in men and women, midlife and older ages who did not have a prior history of heart attack or stroke and were at usual risk. And they overall did not have this cardiovascular disease reduction, but did see a reduction in heart attack.
And this population that you were directly studying, were any of those on statins or was it a mix?
There were about one-third, a little over one-third on statins, and we did not see that made a difference in terms of the effects of the fish oil supplements.
So what do you make of your study and looking at this other one at the 4 gram level about, you know, what's the next aspect of this to study when it comes to fish oil and heart health?
Well, we think that for primary prevention, surprisingly, this is the first large-scale randomized trial of fish oil in a usual risk study population. There have been many previous studies looking at high risk individuals who either have a history of heart disease, stroke, or have selected risk factors. But because this is the first trial, we do think it will be very helpful to try to confirm and replicate these findings. And if the reduction in heart attack and various heart disease events can be confirmed, this may become a very important way of reducing heart disease risk.
And again, the 28% reduction in heart attack, but you didn't see any overall benefit other than that? I'm just trying to clarify that.
For the primary endpoint of combined cardiovascular events, which included heart attack, stroke, and death from cardiovascular disease, we saw only a small 8% reduction that was not statistically significant. But when we looked at the various components of that primary endpoint, looking at heart attack specifically, where actually most of the prior evidence has been for benefits with the fish oil and omega-3s in primary prevention and observational studies, we did see the significant reduction in heart attack.
What's your theory as to why you would see it with heart attacks but not with other evidence of heart risk?
Well, there are many differences in risk factors for heart disease and stroke. And stroke is a very complex endpoint. It includes bleeding types of stroke, as well as strokes that are due to atherosclerosis. That's the major mechanism. Some of the pathways are very similar for heart attack and strokes, but some differ. One of the benefits of the omega-3s is that it seems to stabilize the heart rhythm, and people may be less likely to go into an irregular heart rhythm that can be linked to death with a heart attack. And that could be why there's more of a benefit here for heart than for stroke outcomes. But also the anti-clotting effect of omega-3s, the effect on reducing inflammation, some of these pathways may be, in general, more particularly relevant to heart attack risk.
We're talking with Dr. Joanne Manson, who was the lead author of the Vital study published over the weekend in the New England Journal of Medicine, study looking at over a longer period of time the effect of taking fish oils as a supplement in a typical middle-aged population, what we saw there, and also a separate study which looked at a more intense, larger dosage of EPA, a component of fish oil, which showed substantial benefit for those at higher risk of major heart events, particularly those with higher triglyceride levels. Now, I also want to ask you about vitamin D, which has been touted as having a benefit in suppressing cancer and also in heart health. What did the study say about vitamin D supplementation?
So we tested a moderate to high dose of 2,000 international units per day. And what we found was that there wasn't a reduction in cardiovascular events or the number of diagnoses of cancer. However, we did see a promising signal for a reduction in cancer death. And this has been suggested by previous randomized trials of vitamin D, as well as some of the observational or association research. Now, this could happen if vitamin D specifically affects the biology of tumors such that they become less aggressive, less likely to be invasive, and to lead to metastasis. And there is some evidence from clinical laboratory research as well as previous randomized trials that that may in fact be the case, that the reduction is more for cancer death than for a first diagnosis of cancer. It can take a very long time to see benefits of vitamin D in relation to cancer. So we plan to follow the participants for longer, hopefully up to another 5 years, and see whether the signal for a reduction in cancer death may increase over time.
So in other words, the potential is, based on your results over these 5 years, is that it serves as a braking mechanism, potentially, that vitamin D is slowing down the growth of the tumor.
Potentially. Again, these are not absolutely conclusive findings.
Mm-hmm.
And And these need to be, the participants need to be followed longer, and also additional research is needed. But this is a promising signal from the study.
And again, the vitamin D observation you were doing, this was in a typical population. You weren't looking, say, at cancer patients, for example.
No, but it takes a long time for a tumor to come to clinical detection. In other words, many people have what we call subclinical, you know, cancer, and it may be affecting the cancer's behavior even before it's diagnosed or comes to clinical detection.
Hmm. Is there some way to actually study that, you know, very directly in a laboratory, the, you know, vitamin D actually on a tumor? Is there a way to mimic that in a lab?
Yes, that has been looked at, and there are some favorable effects of the high-dose vitamin D on the tumor cell behavior. And that's one of the reasons why this signal seems particularly promising, because some of the laboratory research has pointed in this direction, and some of the earlier randomized trials, when they're looked at in combination, have suggested that there may be a benefit in reducing cancer death. But we don't think it's a conclusive finding yet, but very promising.
And finally, Dr. Manson, real quickly, did you look at vitamin D versus heart health?
Yes, we saw no reduction with vitamin D in heart attack or stroke risk.
All right. Dr. Manson, thank you so much. Feel like I understand it a lot better. I appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Dr. Joanne Manson, who is a professor of epidemiology at Harvard, a practicing physician and chief of preventive medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. She was the lead author of the VITAL study, which has received tremendous amounts of attention in the New England Journal of Medicine. It was published over the weekend. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we'll talk about the lawsuits CNN filed against the White House over the revocation of correspondent Jim Acosta's credentials. So good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Many big news stories that we're covering today, including a federal judge expected to decide today whether the White House can continue to hold the press credential for CNN's Jim Acosta. You might recall that last week the White House pulled Acosta's credentials after a particularly contentious news conference in which Acosta didn't want to yield the microphone, was asking a number of questions of President Trump, President taking issue with it, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, White House press secretary, also taking issue. And after that news conference, his credentials were pulled. So the federal judge in Washington around noon our time expected to rule on this. Joining us to talk about the legal issues at play and what latitude a White House has to revoke credentials is UCLA law professor Eugene Volokh. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Always a great pleasure. And as I was waiting, I was hearing your pledge drive and reminded me that I hadn't donated yet. So I just donated my contribution. So
thank you so much, Eugene. I appreciate it very, very much. So let's talk about is there actual case law on this where we've had a credential revocation before and it's gone to court?
Well, the answer is yes, that there was a journalist who was denied a press pass about 40 years ago. He was a Washington correspondent for The Nation. And the D.C. Circuit said he had a First Amendment right not to be denied the press pass, at least based on his viewpoint. Between that case and later Supreme Court precedents on not quite this issue, but some related issues, it looks like the government can deny someone a press pass because of his conduct. Like, for example, if they say, you know, he was hogging the mic, he wasn't giving up the mic, he was orating or trying to orate instead of asking questions. There's this allegation that he pushed an intern. I'm not sure if that's right or not. But based on that, the government can deny a press pass, but not based on the person's viewpoint.
Hmm. So might it be up to the judge then to determine whether Acosta's conduct would somehow entitled the administration to remove his credential?
Yes, that seems to be so. And the judge could say, you know, it looks to me like this was based on viewpoint, so they've got to give him back the credential. He could say it looks like it wasn't, in which case they could deny it. You know, 99.9999% of us literally don't have access to the White House press room, so he could just be one of those very many who doesn't. Or alternatively, the judge could say, look, this is a preliminary hearing. There hasn't been a lot of fact-finding. Nobody's entitled to a preliminary injunction. I'm going to exercise my discretion to just deny it for now and then see what emerges through the facts, or even grant it for now and see what facts emerge. This is a very early decision in the case, and it's going to be a very tentative decision.
Now, CNN, of course, is still going to have representation in news conferences. Does that factor into it, that a judge might look and say, well, Acosta, the administration doesn't believe he's conducted himself in a way to keep, but CNN is still going to be represented, presumably by someone asking tough questions of the president, so the speech issue would be covered? Or would they potentially look at it and say, well, Acosta's been particularly pointed in his questions, and to remove him personally interferes with the ability of a free press to challenge a president?
Right. So I think that's an excellent point. I think that's why, as a First Amendment matter, on the substantive question, it probably shouldn't matter much, partly because Acosta is saying I have my own rights, but partly because CNN could say, look, we have the right to be represented by the person we choose as the best person to kind of articulate our questions. This having been said, that might be relevant to the judge's decision whether to exercise his discretion to grant the preliminary injunction, because it involves something which in law is called a balance of the hardships. Just how much of a harm would there be if there's an error either way? May say it's not such a big deal. The flip side, by the way, is, as I understand it, President Trump could just refuse to call on him. So it may not be that much of a hardship to allow Acosta in there. And then if President Trump really doesn't want to hear his questions, he doesn't have to call on Acosta. And presumably, if Acosta just shouts things out without being called on, then he could have his press pass pulled. So really, it's interesting. There's not really that much at stake here. It's not the fate of the republic turning on this issue in either direction.
But it is interesting.
An interesting question, though.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a very interesting question because, again, getting at the issue of what's being filtered out here. Is it a president bristling at the relentless questioning of Acosta, or is it critics of Acosta put it, that it's about an administration trying to deal with someone who's grandstanding and sort of actually interrupting what's going on in the news conference? I'm just hearing from listeners, what do you think about this? And do you think this is an infringement on speech and media's ability to cover in the revocation of Acosta's press credentials? Or do you think that there is a case to be made for the way he's conducted himself, for having someone else from CNN there instead of him and the credential being revoked? 866-893-KPECC. I mean, of course, the practical irony here, Professor, is that this is very good for CNN and for Acosta. This is, I mean, it's all part of the spectacle and theater around this.
Yes, I think so. I think so. If this were maybe on House of Cards, there'd be some sort of payment, like Acosta handing over an envelope.
Yeah, thank you for revoking my credentials.
Thank you so much for picking on me.
Yeah, no, I could just picture Trump and Acosta doing a joint reality show after the administration is done because of the way they've they are. No, it's a good point. Yeah, they are in essence doing their version of a reality show and kind of feeding each other in these sessions. We're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. One of the things I would think that CNN and the other media organizations that have come in with amicus briefs would possibly try and show is, other journalists in those briefings conducting themselves the same as Acosta and nothing happening to them, would that make a potentially strong case on Acosta's behalf? Eugene?
Yes, I think that it could go either way. On the one hand, CNN could say, look, other people have hogged the mic and you didn't do anything to them. That would cut in favor of the that would be evidence that the real reason was his viewpoint. On the other hand, I think the White House can say lots of other correspondents have asked really hard questions and hostile questions and have had hostile coverage. And in fact, I suspect President Trump has actually lashed out at some of them already. But we didn't pull their press passes, right? That shows that the real reason we did it is precisely because of his obstructionist conduct and not just because of his viewpoint. Look, if the White House really did pull the press pass of all reporters whose viewpoint it didn't like, there wouldn't be many left.
All right. So if you had to lay money on this, Professor, what do you think we'd be apt to hear coming up at noon?
Oh, I never make predictions, especially about the future.
Okay. All right. Eugene Volokh, UCLA law professor, as always, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. Tony writes on the Air Talk page, Acosta was hogging the mic and debating, not questioning, and he clearly made contact with the intern. There was that video that was put out by, that was retweeted by Sarah Huckabee Sanders, which it allegedly been doctored to make his hand look more like it was striking with greater contact with the intern who was trying to take the mic from Acosta in that news conference last week. We'll see what the judge has to say about it. Again, that's at noon our time, the hearing in D.C. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. Great to have you with us today on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, we'll take a look at genetically edited food. We're going to be seeing products on store shelves shortly that have the CRISPR-type process. That doesn't mean like your vegetable snaps. It's the technique for actually splicing, taking something out of a gene that might be considered a negative for a particular type of food. We'll take a look at that coming up later this hour. But right now, we turn our attention to the FDA's newly announced rules about vaping and tobacco. The announcement is that there'll be new rules on the sales of flavored cigarettes, flavored cigars, and the flavored solutions that are part of some of the vaping products. With us is USA Today healthcare policy reporter Jane O'Donnell. Jane, good to have you with us.
My pleasure to be here.
So let's lay out, first of all, what are the new point of sale rules when it comes to vaping products?
So what's going to change is that if you want any of the flavored products like the cotton candy or even the creme brulee, which may not sound like a child's favorite flavor, you'd have to go to an actual vape store, or you'd have to go to go online where you'd face far tougher age verification rules that are still fairly undetermined. So places where a lot of young people are getting their products, things like convenience stores, gas stations, 7-Eleven, would not be able to sell these products because they're not about to card everybody who walks in the door.
Well, at this point, with like in California, for example, tobacco cigarettes, can only be sold to someone over the age of 18. So convenience stores already are in the habit of carding people who are buying cigarettes. What was the FDA's thinking about not just doing the same when it comes to vaping products?
Right. But apparently what they found when they were doing enforcement actions, they were going out and doing, I guess you can call them stings. The commissioner of the FDA, Scott Gottlieb, was here at our offices yesterday, and he was saying they expected maybe they'd find 300 or so convenience stores that weren't doing what you're describing when it comes to vaping, but it was 1,300. It was very common for them to not be thinking of vaping, these e-cigarette pods and devices, at the same way they were thinking about cigarettes. So that's why they thought it was necessary that they would actually change the policy so dramatically.
And I guess they didn't have confidence that they could comply with the vaping products in the same way they presumably comply with tobacco products.
Right, and it's such a big, as you know, and I assume your listeners know, but there's a very big public health risk here if you addict a whole new generation of young people to nicotine just when we as a society are starting to make progress in getting people off of cigarettes. Cigarette smoking was at the lowest level ever last week when the new numbers came out, but these kids could end up starting smoking because they've got these nicotine habits now.
I can't remember the last time I saw a kid smoking a cigarette. Vaping products I see all the time, but it's just been so long. Jane O'Donnell of USA Today, healthcare policy reporter. And Jane, what about menthol tobacco cigarettes? What are the new rules on menthol?
Yeah, it's been discussed for a long time, and finally, interestingly, somebody in government is taking action, plans to take action to do something about it. This has to go a different route. It has to go through the rulemaking process, but Commissioner Gottlieb says that the FDA are going to propose rules that would ban menthol cigarettes. One of the many problems with menthol cigarettes are that they're disproportionately used by lower socioeconomic people who already have health challenges. They're very popular with African Americans, and who are often mistakenly thinking that because they aren't as abrasive and the menthol makes them, I guess, go down easier, for lack of a better word, that they're not as dangerous. And of course they are.
All right. Jane O'Donnell, thank you so much for laying out the new rules from the FDA. Jane O'Donnell, USA Today, healthcare policy reporter. Joining us as well, drug policy expert, professor at New York University, Mark Kleiman. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Larry, it's always a pleasure.
First, let's talk about the menthol cigarettes and the proposed rule banning them. Your thoughts on that and what effects that might have.
There is no evidence that menthol is more dangerous than non-menthol. It's clear that if you ban menthol, a certain number of menthol smokers will stop smoking because they don't like regular. By the same token, if you ban regular cigarettes, required all cigarettes to be menthol, then a bunch of people like regular cigarettes would quit. And since that's a larger number, that would be the bigger public health impact. There doesn't seem to me to be any particular justification for banning menthol.
And your thoughts about changing the rules over where people can purchase?
The real issue with banning menthol is some people quit, some people switch to regular or other tobacco products, and some people will buy illicit cigarettes.
And that's a fairly large market in this country, isn't it, to buy black market tobacco?
This is generally not illicitly manufactured tobacco. It's mostly legal cigarettes smuggled in from low-tax jurisdictions. But New York City, probably half the cigarettes come from Virginia or North Carolina because the taxes are so much lower. If menthol cigarettes are banned nationally, then that's not a possibility. But it's clear that people are willing to do that. The thing is, turns out mentholating a cigarette's not very hard. The way a tobacco company mentholates cigarettes is they stick some paper, the paper that lines the cigarette package, soak in menthol.
That's all you have to do.
That's all you do. The menthol evaporates, and those are now menthol cigarettes.
So
you can buy menthol at a hardware store.
Okay, so anybody could do this on. I mean, a person could even roll their own using.
Well, yeah. And menthol cigarettes aren't just ordinary cigarettes with menthol. The rest of the cigarette is designed, you know, the tobacco mix is designed to go with menthol. But, you know, they're not going to make it illegal to do that. So I would expect a modest impact on smoking and some increase in illicit transactions. However, if menthol vape were available, then I'd expect a bunch of menthol smokers to migrate to menthol vape. And since that's about 5% as dangerous as smoking, that'd be a big public health gain.
All right. Mark Lyman with us, NYU professor of public policy and drug policy expert. Professor, what about making it more limited where people can buy the flavored vape products?
Again, if they compete with cigarettes, it's probably a bad thing. And in particular, if you're going to make menthol cigarettes unavailable, you want to make sure that menthol vape is available so that people will switch to that rather than buying illegal menthol cigarettes or mentholating their own cigarettes. There's no evidence that I know of that people move from vaping to smoking. Why would they? If you're going to get your nicotine from vaping, why would you pay extra to cough? It just doesn't seem to make any sense at all. And what we know over time is the fraction of kids vaping has gone up, the fraction of kids smoking has gone way down. So I think there's an irrational concern about nicotine use among minors. Obviously, you'd prefer a teenager not to be using nicotine if that were your choice. But given the ratio of harm between combustibles and non-combustibles, I think we should be doing anything to discourage non-combustible use.
We're talking with Mark Lyman, NYU professor. Coming up, we'll talk with the president of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, Matt Myers, and hear his thoughts about the new FDA rules. What does he think? Do they go as far as he would like to see on restrictions on vaping products as well as on tobacco cigarettes? You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. And I do remind you, you can also weigh in on this. What do you think of these new rules? Particularly interested if you're a vapor or a smoker, what you think about it. We're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722 to take part in our conversation, which continues. I know that you might be closely following the Florida elections where the recount is underway in the gubernatorial and U.S. Senate races there. A federal judge just slammed the state for repeatedly failing to anticipate election problems, said state law and recounts appears to violate the U.S. Supreme Court ruling that was issued in 2000. That, of course, having to do with Florida, you know, who was going to take the presidency. U.S. District Judge Mark Walker rejected a request to extend the deadline later in the day for all of the state's counties to submit the results of a machine recount. The judge saying, we've been the laughingstock of the world election after election, and we chose not to fix this. So the judge got pretty hot on the bench and lambasted Palm Beach County officials as well as state lawmakers. Say they didn't have enough equipment in place to handle the recount. So we'll see what happens. They faced a deadline of 3 o'clock Eastern time. That's a half hour away. That's noon our time for when the recount was supposed to be concluded. And the latest we saw, it was not going to meet that deadline. So anyway, the latest on ongoing election fiasco in Florida. We continue our focus on the FDA and its announcement today that it's going to restrict the sale of vape products to places that can restrict to 18 and older on-site purchases, as well as websites that can do accurate verification of age for the sale of flavored vaping products. Also, the FDA is pursuing a rulemaking change which would ban menthol tobacco cigarettes. Joining us is Matt Myers, the president of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. Mr. Myers, first of all, would you like to see the FDA go further than they're doing with today's announcements?
Well, with regard to e-cigarettes, the answer is yes. With regard to menthol cigarettes, contrary to what your last guest said, there's overwhelming evidence that menthol cigarettes dramatically increase the number of kids who start smoking. Over 54% of the kids in this country start with menthol cigarettes. If you eliminated menthol, you would dramatically reduce the number of kids who become addicted in the first place. There's something else that your last guest didn't talk about, too, which is smokers of menthol cigarettes have a harder time quitting. So it directly contributes to health disparities in this country. It's one of the reasons why African Americans are dying of lung cancer rates higher than their peers. So there is really an extraordinarily well-documented scientific case for why FDA was right to take this action with regard to menthol. It's been shown by scientific committees in prestigious bodies around the globe. The other thing that I think is important to understand as well is that by banning menthol cigarettes, what the scientific evidence shows is a significant number of people will quit, and that FDA has put in place procedures to help those who can't quit to switch. So there's very little evidence that it would produce much in terms of an illicit market. With regard to electronic cigarettes, FDA has taken an important step with regard to it. What we have seen is that FDA acted precisely because the data shows a meteoric rise in the use of electronic cigarettes by our nation's kids. What's disturbing is twofold. First is that it shows that most of these kids are not kids who are at risk of smoking, so it's kids who would otherwise not be exposed to nicotine at all. And second, that the data released today shows that 27% of the kids who are using these products are doing so 20 or more days a month, which means they're not just playing around, they've become addicted. So that what FDA is doing is taking a strong step in order to prevent the e-cigarette industry from addicting another generation of America's kids. When you look at the facts, the evidence is overwhelming in support of what the FDA has proposed to do. Yes, I'd like to see them do more, because one of the things that FDA didn't do was it didn't ban or restrict the sale of flavors like mint or menthol. And their own data shows that over 50% of kids who use these products use mint or menthol products.
Now, a lot of people, though, at least we've heard from them when we've talked about vaping on the show, people who've gotten off cigarettes and switched to vaping have found that the flavored products were often a helpful way for them to make that jump. Is there not evidence to support that?
Well, in fact, there's anecdotal evidence of individuals saying that. But there isn't scientific evidence to say that on a broad population basis. But it's important to understand what FDA did and didn't do. FDA does not propose to ban all flavors or to eliminate the use of flavors that have been shown to help smokers quit. What FDA has done is it has taken an action to restrict the easy availability of flavors that are currently being used by large numbers of kids. We're not talking about adult smokers. And with evidence that over 80% of kids who use e-cigarettes say they do so precisely because of the flavors. This is not an either-or. You don't have to either protect adults or protect kids. The difficulty is that the e-cigarette industry has irresponsibly marketed products with high appeal to kids and used social media marketing that made them more appealing to kids.
Professor Kleiman, you want to respond to that?
Well, all I can say is that correlation is not causation. The fact that a bunch of kids are using flavored vape doesn't mean that they wouldn't be using non-flavored vape. And it seems to me absurd to say that taking vapor products out of convenience locations isn't going to reduce the use of those vapor products by adults as well as kids. And since we know that vape is the most effective way for people to quit smoking, that seems to me, from a public health point of view, not a very good idea.
Mr. Myers, I also wanted to ask, you said there's...
Can I just respond?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Gordon, the National Academy of Sciences has actually looked at the issue. And while certain people make broad statements about how much these products help people smoke, they found that the evidence is actually quite limited. And the most recent study shows that on a population-based basis, vape products are not improving quit rates or cessation rates. The other important thing to know is that the data released last week by the CDC and this week by the FDA demonstrate that there's very little correlation with the use of vape and the reduction in tobacco use in this country. So there's a lot of platitudes that are being made, but very little scientific evidence to support them.
Now, as I was looking at the CDC numbers from last week that you referenced, and didn't it show that among those that that vaped, that you had you know, a lower, because you figure those are the most risk-taking kids, you're sort of taking off the top, that there actually was a positive benefit when it came to smoking of tobacco from kids vaping instead?
No, it's just the opposite. What the CDC data shows is two things, that increasingly the kids who use vape products are not the kids who are most at risk of smoking, which is really important. And second, that there is a growing body of evidence now agreed upon by virtually everybody that's credible, that the use of vape products increases the likelihood that a kid will go on to become a smoker.
So you think we're going to see an explosion in tobacco smoking among kids because of all the vapors?
Hmm?
You think we're going to see an explosion in cigarette smoking because of all the kids who were vaping?
With the scientific evidence in multiple studies, and the FDA itself said this morning, is that there is a very strong correlation that between the number of kids who vape and an increased risk of actually smoking. It's not what I think or not. It's what the scientific evidence shows.
All right. Mark Kleiman, your thoughts about that?
True. Yeah, over time, the opposite is true. As vaping rates among teenagers have gone up, smoking rates among teenagers have gone down.
Well, exactly the opposite was shown today in the data. What we saw is a dramatic rise.
Hold on. So you're seeing a rise in youth smoking cigarettes, Matt Myers?
What we saw today is that the data shows that even last year, as we had a 75% increase in use of vape products by kids, we had no decrease in the use of other tobacco products by these kids. So what it shows is that the increased use of vaping products is not at all correlated with a decreased use of cigarettes. It also shows over time that if this trend continues, the data demonstrates that it will in the long run probably lead to an increase in smoking, not to a decrease in smoking. So if you look at the data, then what you say is what FDA has done today will both help our nation with regard to kids and eventually lead to better, more effective tobacco cessation efforts.
Matt Myers, president of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. Professor Mark Kleiman, quick final word.
When you do a survey of menthol smokers and ask them what they would do if menthol weren't available, half of them say they'd quit. Now, we know the success rate in smoking cessation is about 1 in 6. So that leaves about a third of current menthol smokers looking for illicit menthol. And that's what we're going to find.
Professor Mark Kleiman, NYU, Professor of Public Policy. Matt Myers, Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. You can share your comments about the new FDA guidelines for sale of flavored vaping products, as well as they're seeking a rule banning menthol tobacco cigarettes. Well, you've, of course, heard of GMOs, genetically modified organisms, plants or animals, whose DNA is mixed with another species to get some sort of a specific or positive trait that you want. And even though the scientific community is largely supportive of GMOs, you still have people who are never going to touch products that are GMO. And they want certified GMO-free products. But we expect coming up later this year that gene-edited foods could hit grocery store shelves. What is the difference? What is gene-edited versus GMO? With us is Alan McEwen, professor of molecular genetics at UC Riverside, and he's author of Pandora's Picnic Basket, The Potential and Hazards of Genetically Modified Foods. Professor McEwen, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me, Larry.
So you've been a science advisor to the Secretary of State, policy analyst for the White House. You've been immersed in a lot of this stuff. So let's start first of all with a description of a product on store shelves that has a gene splicing as opposed to gene modifications, GMOs.
Well, if you want an example, probably the most obvious to me is the papaya from Hawaii that has been genetically engineered to resist the papaya ring spot virus, which wipes out papaya plantations throughout the tropics. That's been on the market now for a number of years, very successful at maintaining the papaya industry in Hawaii. Among the things that are not gene spliced are the things that you tend to hear about, like genetically engineered corn or soybean or canola, all produce vegetable oil. But by the time consumers buy a bottle of corn oil, it's exactly the same whether it comes from a corn plant that was genetically engineered or a traditional corn plant that hasn't been genetically engineered. So it's there's a misconception there that people think that they're eating gene-spliced foods frequently with the DNAs and proteins, but they are not.
All right. And explain how the splicing is actually done. And the papaya is an example of a gene-spliced product?
Yes. So that was done back in the 1990s. And again, people don't it's not a high-profile example, but it is a very successful example of using genetic engineering to overcome, to enable us to continue to grow, in this case, papaya in Hawaii that's otherwise devastated by this ring spot virus. The genetic engineering is I want to make this point. Genetic engineering is just a tool. You can use the tool to develop lots of different things in virtually every crop, every plant, every animal, every microbe used in agriculture and food, and also for that reason in medicines and pharmaceuticals. Like insulin itself now is a gene-spliced product. And so there's a lot of products out there. We've been doing this since the 1990s. It's been in the food supply, and there's still not a single documented case of harm from the consumption of any genetically engineered food.
Well, it's funny because I think of this, what's called the CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-E-R, technology as comparatively recent, but you're describing it being around in ag for quite a while.
Well, I'm talking about genetic modification in terms of recombinant DNA technologies. Yes, that technology has been around for quite a while now. When you're talking about CRISPR, we're talking about genome editing. CRISPR talents, there's a number of other techniques that were all developed in the last 10 years or so. The products are just coming online now. And the big difference between these gene-edited or genome-edited products and what I might call traditionally genetically engineered products is the gene-edited products don't necessarily involve transfer of DNA or other genetic material from other species into our crop species. That is, with gene editing, we can take a corn plant or a soybean plant or a papaya plant, for that matter, and change the DNA sequence within the plant itself without necessarily adding any other DNA from any other source to provide a beneficial new trait, whether that trait is something like a disease resistance or to enhance the nutritional profile or some other thing that scientists can think up.
Well, and are there potential unintended consequences when you do that sort of gene editing that maybe, you know, the portion that you're removing has an effect that isn't at first noticeable, something negative that goes along with the positive you're seeing right away?
Sure. Well, that's it's a great question, and this is a question that we in the scientific community have been asking from the very beginning. And if you're familiar with the U.S. National Academies of Science, the academies have been investigating these questions going back to 1986. And when they investigate the situation, these unintended consequences with the gene editing, what they come up with, the conclusion is that while you can never say with 100% certainty, what we see with gene-edited products is that they are much the same as we see with traditional breeding going back 10,000 of years. And furthermore, because the gene-edited products are analyzed at a much more precise molecular level, the scientists who develop them and the regulators who regulate them have a pretty good sense that, if we remove something crucial, then we're going to notice that, and that product will never make it on the market. Or if we removed something crucial and the plant starts inexplicably making some toxin or allergen that's not a natural part of the plant to begin with, we'll notice those things too, and that product will never get on the market. So we have a high degree of confidence that gene-edited products are at least as safe as traditionally bred products.
So you're just speeding up the process is what you're contending.
It's not only speeding
up. And making it more precise, too.
We know exactly what we're doing with the DNA when we do gene editing, whereas in contrast, a traditional form of breeding that goes back to the 1940s is mutation breeding, induced mutation breeding, where we use things like ionizing radiation to scramble the DNA in the plant, and then we grow up tens of thousands of plants from that irradiation and try to seek out the few plants that may have traits that are beneficial. Now, something over 3,000 different crop varieties were developed using induced mutagenesis like that since the 1940s. They've never been problematic, but we scientists don't know exactly what we did to them genetically at a DNA level. So they're safe, they're beneficial, they're in the marketplace, we eat them virtually every day, but we don't know exactly what happened. With gene editing, we do know exactly what happened at the DNA level, so we have a much better sense of whether there's going to be any problems arise.
We're talking with UC Riverside Professor of Molecular Genetics, Alan McEwen, author of Pandora's Picnic Basket, former science advisor to the Secretary of State in 2011, and policy analyst for the White House in 2012. What is the potential of this? If you can get to this precise genetic level in different products, could you make a tomato theoretically that would, last for 2 months?
Well, yes, and that's one of the first products that's coming along. Consumers aren't particularly interested in the long shelf life. I mean, we did have a tomato on the market a number of years ago, the Flavor Saver tomato in the 90s. It was okay as a product, but people didn't like it that much. The flavor on the Flavor Saver
wasn't much.
Right, so it fell out of favor. But it is one of the types of traits that could be transferred using genome editing. But as I mentioned earlier, it is just a tool. We could provide tomatoes with long shelf life, but we can also do things like develop allergen-free peanuts or tree nuts. We could take gluten out of wheat. We could develop citrus that's resistant to Long Wong Bing disease that's devastated the citrus industry in Florida, and now it's in California. It's also been used to develop non-toxic cotton, removing the toxins from cotton to provide a protein source. Now, we don't eat the cotton meal, but in parts of the world,
all right,
the meal remaining from the seed after the oil is squeezed out is a very high protein, nutritious substance.
Hey, Professor, I want to thank you so much. Fascinating. Alan McEwen of UC Riverside joining us on Air Talk.